We're going to start now. Hi, my name is Donnie Weintraub. I'm a biomajor at Yeshiva University and a member of the Yeshiva University Student Medical Ethics Society. And I'd like to welcome you all to Multifetal Reduction with Rabbi Dr. Zalman Levine. Rabbi Dr. Levine works as a physician in the field of reproductive endocrinology and infertility. After having received his smicha in 1991, Dr. Levine received his MD from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in 1995 and completed his postgraduate residency training in obstetrics and gynecology at Albert Einstein as well. Following this, he spent three fellowship years studying reproductive medicine and surgery at Harvard University. Rabbi Dr. Levine has performed clinical and laboratory research at Einstein and Harvard in areas of IVF, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and endometriosis. He is also board certified in reproductive endocrinology, infertility, obstetrics, and gynecology. Today he will be discussing a very sensitive matter. He will discuss the medical and halachic areas of high-risk multifetal pregnancies. He will focus on the idea of selectively aborting, in the case of multifetal pregnancy, one or more of the fetuses in order to preserve the lives of the fetuses which stand a better chance to survive. As I've heard from my father, who's a colleague of Rabbi Dr. Levine, if there's anyone who has served as an exemplary messenger of Hashem in the area of conception of human life and who has aided in the midst of Pur Avu to the greatest extent, it is Rabbi Dr. Levine, and he's an outstanding physician as well as outstanding Talmud Chacham. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Rabbi Dr. Zalman Levine.
Thank you very much, Donnie. The field of reproductive biology has advanced enormously over the past 30 years. Now, in the year 2007, many couples who are suffering from infertility can be helped enormously with the various techniques of assisted reproduction. These techniques have all been and continue to be extensively examined in the light of halacha and hashkafa. But in addition to the fundamental questions of the permissibility of these various forms of assisted reproductive techniques and the status of the embryos and the children that are conceived through these techniques, we also have to concern ourselves with the risks of reproductive treatments and with the question of how halacha will handle the outcomes, sometimes the risky outcomes, of these reproductive therapies. Because poskim are frequently consulted by couples regarding all different steps of their fertility treatments, the halachic world really has to be informed about all aspects of reproductive therapy, including one of its major risks, and that is the risk of multiple pregnancy. So the purpose of this session, which I entitled "In Excess of Success," is to give you an overview of the problem of multiple pregnancy, including its epidemiology, its causes, its consequences, and to outline what can be done to prevent the conception of a multiple pregnancy and what can be done medically and halachically if a multiple pregnancy should occur. Multiple pregnancy in general has been developing into a larger and larger problem during the past 25 years. Data from the National Center for Health Statistics demonstrate that twin births have increased by about 55% from 1980, at the beginning of this slide, all the way up to the year 2000 at the end. Approximately in 1980, approximately 1.9 out of every 100 births were twins, and that number rose to 2.9 per 100 by the year 2000. And these data are even more dramatic for higher-order multiple pregnancies, which is this curve over here. Triplets are greater. In 1980, approximately out of every 10,000 live births, about 3.7 of them were higher-order multiple pregnancy births. By 2000, this number has almost quintupled, has risen almost by 500% to account for a full 18 out of every 10,000 live births in the United States. In absolute numbers, you really can see the drama of it. In 1980, there were 1,300 some odd high-order multiple births reported in the United States, while in 2000, there were over 7,000 high-order multiple births in total, and this number included almost about 6,700 triplet births, about 500 quadruplets, and 77 sets of quintuplets. And actually, these data understate the trend because they reflect only the live multiple births. And in fact, many more multiple pregnancies are conceived than are born because pregnancy losses, miscarriages, particularly for high-order multiple pregnancies, are very common. Approximately one-third of all twin conceptions, about half of all triplet conceptions, and around two-thirds of all quadruplet conceptions actually end in spontaneous pregnancy losses. Now, live births are reported to and compiled by the National Center for Health Statistics, but pregnancy losses are not reported. So the number of high-order multiple conceptions is actually significantly higher than the astoundingly high numbers of multiple births. So why is this? What is the reason for this trend? And the answer is really twofold. First of all, in general, in the United States, there has been a shift in maternal age distribution. There's been a greater number of women who have been delaying childbearing for various reasons, for social, educational, economic reasons, and consequently, a greater number of women are becoming pregnant later on in their reproductive years. Now, physiologically, an older woman is more likely than a younger woman to ovulate more than one egg in a given menstrual cycle, and is therefore more likely to have a multiple conception and a multiple birth. This trend towards older childbearing is certainly responsible for part of the increase in multiple births that we've been seeing over the past 25 years, but it probably is only responsible for about 20% of this increase. And also, since the vast majority of the multiple births that result from this factor, from an older maternal age, are twin pregnancies, this factor accounts for very, very little of the increased trend in higher order multiple births in triplets or more. It almost entirely accounts for the increase in twin pregnancies. The second factor is by far the more significant one. The increasing use of fertility treatments from 1980 to the present accounts for about 80% of this increase in multiple births and for almost all of the increase in the high order multiple pregnancies, the high order multiple births. The major assisted reproductive culprits that cause this increased incidence of high-order multiple pregnancies are the techniques of IVF, of in vitro fertilization, and of superovulation with or without insemination. Generally, both of these treatment techniques require the administration of injectable hormones, such as FSH, which is follicle-stimulating hormone, or LH, which is luteinizing hormone. FSH and LH are naturally occurring hormones, which every reproductive age woman produces cyclically during the course of each menstrual cycle in order to help her ovaries produce or prepare an egg. In reproductive medicine, these hormones are administered to women by injection in supraphysiologic doses, in doses that are higher than what she is physiologically exposed to, in order to drive the ovaries to develop several or even many eggs. And this process is known as controlled ovarian hyperstimulation. We hyperstimulate the ovaries in a controlled and carefully monitored fashion. Unfortunately, because reproductive medicine is not yet efficient enough to give patient couples a good chance of a pregnancy, successful pregnancy, with a single egg, and maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu will never let it get to the point of being successful enough to be successful with a single egg, because he alone holds the Mafteach Shel Chaya, as the Gemara in Tainus tells us. And therefore, in order to help many couples be able to achieve a pregnancy or a reasonable chance of a pregnancy, we really have to try to induce the development of several eggs. And we carefully monitor the progress of egg development within the ovaries during this process. In this ultrasound picture of a hyperstimulated ovary, we can see approximately 8 to 10 eggs that are maturing and preparing for a hopeful pregnancy. Once these hormonal injections have successfully guided the development of several or multiple eggs within the woman's ovaries, these eggs can now be used either for IVF or for insemination. For IVF, the eggs are removed from the ovaries through a surgical procedure which is known as the egg retrieval, which is really a bit of a misnomer, but we call it the egg retrieval. The woman's eggs, and this is a human egg, are removed from her ovaries, and they're introduced to the husband's sperm cells in the laboratory. And they're grown and observed in the laboratory. The resulting embryos are grown and observed in the laboratory for several days. And several days later, these embryos are gently placed into the woman's uterus in a procedure which is known as the embryo transfer. Alternatively, Once several eggs have matured within the woman's ovaries through the use of these injectable medications, rather than remove these eggs from the woman's body through IVF, the eggs can be allowed to ovulate inside the woman's reproductive tract as they normally and naturally do. In such a case, the eggs will hopefully find their way into the fallopian tubes, and there they'll sit and wait for possible contact with sperm the way, again, they normally do in any monthly ovulation. The couple can be together naturally at this point, in which case the only major difference really between this kind of treatment cycle and a natural cycle is in the number of eggs that are waiting in the fallopian tube for possible fertilization. In a natural cycle, usually a single egg ovulates and waits for possible fertilization, while in a super ovulation treatment cycle, there are actually several eggs that are available and ready for a meeting with the sperm cells. Or the chances of such a meeting can be increased by actually performing an intrauterine insemination, where we gently place the husband's sperm cells high up inside the uterus to give the sperm cells a head start, to give them a shorter distance to swim to the egg, and overall to give them a higher likelihood of being able to find their way to at least one of those eggs. It's clear why multiple pregnancy can result from either type of reproductive therapy. For IVF, several embryos are placed into the woman's uterus in order to maximize the likelihood of a pregnancy. But just to an extent, as putting in more embryos will increase the likelihood of a pregnancy, so will it increase the likelihood of a multiple pregnancy should several of those embryos successfully implant into the uterus. And for superovulation, just as inducing the ovulation of several eggs will increase the chances of at least one of those eggs fertilizing, so will it also increase the chances of more than one egg fertilizing. As you can see from this figure, as of 1994, the relative contributions of IVF and superovulation to the multiple pregnancy problem have been approximately equivalent, slightly skewed towards the superovulation side. The black represents the relative contribution of superovulation to multiple pregnancies, to singleton, twin, and higher order multiple pregnancies, and the white represents the IVF contribution. Overall, approximately 50 to 60% of treatment-related multiple pregnancies result from superovulation and the remainder from IVF. Superovulation is really the worst offender because it's the least controlled. The ovaries respond with great variability to the injectable medications, and the number of eggs that ovulates is the order of the pregnancy that can result from this treatment. And indeed, as you can see in this pie chart from an accredited clinic in the U.S., overall, and this reflects the U.S. trends in general, approximately 20 to 30% of all pregnancies achieved with superovulation are multiple pregnancies. And in terms of high-order multiple pregnancies, if you multiply this out, about 5 to 10% of all pregnancies achieved through superovulation are high-order multiple pregnancies, triplets or more, which is pretty dramatic. IVF, in contrast, is much more controlled in that the couple and the physician together decide how many embryos to transfer into the wife's uterus, with the rare exception of monozygotic twinning, where one embryo splits into two and that causes identical twins. If no more than one embryo is transferred, then no more than a singleton pregnancy will result. The remaining embryos, by the way, can be frozen or cryopreserved for future use if applicable. In fact, although IVF is more interventional than superovulation and people consider it to be the most aggressive reproductive treatment, IVF for many couples is actually a safer first-line alternative from a multiple pregnancy standpoint. However, while in theory IVF affords this kind of control, the practice, at least in the U.S., has lagged behind the theory. Because of financial, emotional, and professional pressures on couples and on physicians, multiple embryos continue to be transferred in IVF cycles in order to try to maximize the chances of a pregnancy, and this continues to put couples at risk for multiple pregnancies as well. Worldwide, in general, there's been a big push to try to keep the numbers of embryos transferred in IVF cycles to a minimum. And this has actually seen tremendous success in some of the European and Scandinavian countries. And I want to call your attention here to this recently published analysis, this is from recent, of IVF multiple birth data from 1991 through 2004 for Sweden compared with the U.S. And you can see that the multiple birth rate in the U.S. has fallen pretty nicely over the past 10 years. These are the United States data here, but that the multiple birth rate has plummeted dramatically in Sweden in 3 years' time from 2002 and on. And the reason for this is clear when we actually look at the mean number of embryos transferred in IVF cycles in Sweden. We've certainly been doing a pretty good job in the United States at decreasing the numbers of embryos that we've transferred per IVF cycle from a mean of about 4 embryos in 1995 to a mean of about 2.8 embryos today. But Sweden, look at this, actually transfers a mean of 1.3 embryos per IVF cycle. That means the majority of IVF cycles in Sweden are actually single embryo transfers at this point. In June 2006, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, the ASRM, published recommended limits on the numbers of embryos that should be transferred by clinicians here in the United States. Physicians are trying to regulate themselves so that we don't encourage outside regulatory agencies, government agencies, to come and mandate numbers of embryos that need to be transferred. And these limits were actually, the ASRM recommended that a single embryo be transferred for women who are under the age of 35 with a favorable prognosis, with a good chance of achieving a successful pregnancy. While the decisions before the fact as to how many embryos to transfer or how many eggs to allow a woman to superovulate can hopefully minimize the risk of multiple pregnancy, multiple pregnancies will sometimes still occur. And at that point, our attention has to shift to questions like, what are the risks of a multiple pregnancy? And what can we do or must we do to decrease those risks? What do we need to worry about if we have a twin pregnancy? What about if we have this, an early triplet pregnancy seen on this ultrasound? Or what about this, an ongoing quadruplet pregnancy? Or, God forbid, what about something like this, even higher order multiple pregnancy, with actually, if you count them, 7 visible pregnancy sacs seen on this ultrasound of an early septuplet pregnancy? And indeed, multiple pregnancies pose significant risks all around for both the mother and the fetuses, as well as for family and society. The risks of multiple pregnancy can be grouped into fetal risks, maternal risks, economic consequences, and psychosocial impact. From a fetal point of view, the single largest risk, clearly, is that of preterm birth, with the attendant consequences of prematurity. Preterm birth is a very real and very serious issue for multiple pregnancies. The usual duration of human pregnancy is 40 weeks from the last menstrual period, which is approximately 38 weeks from the time of ovulation, from the time of conception. Approximately 50%, a little bit less than 50% of twin pregnancies, this is total prematurity here, about 50% of twin pregnancies deliver early. And look at this, about 90% of triplet pregnancies deliver early, and almost every single quadruplet pregnancy delivers early. And not only do these pregnancies tend to deliver early, but many of them deliver very early. 41% of triplets and almost all quadruplets deliver at less than 33 weeks gestational age, more than 7 weeks, 2 months early. And this is obviously compared with a very low rate for singleton pregnancies of 1.7%. The mean gestational age at delivery drops from about 39 weeks for singleton pregnancies to about 35 to 36 weeks for twin pregnancies, to 32 weeks for a triplet pregnancy, to about 30 weeks for a quadruplet pregnancy. And the baby's weights at birth decrease with the order of pregnancy as well. The mean birth weight for singleton babies is 7.4 pounds, and this drops all the way down to less than 3 pounds for babies born as a quadruplet pregnancy. Unfortunately, premature delivery from the nourishing environment of the uterus can lead to some very, very severe medical complications for the newborn, including intraventricular hemorrhage, which is bleeding in the brain because of the fragility of the baby's underdeveloped blood vessels and neural tissue. It can lead to respiratory distress syndrome because of the immature lungs that are not really ready yet for oxygen exchange. It can lead to disseminated infections because of an underdeveloped, immature immune system. And it can lead to a life-threatening failure of the intestines, which is known as necrotizing enterocolitis. Premature babies can develop blindness. They can develop cerebral palsy as well. And these complications can lead to terrible, terrible consequences, both in terms of disability and in terms of death. From a morbidity, from a disability point of view, the percentage of premature babies with a major handicap, a handicap that will lead to lifelong major disabilities, is extremely and tragically high. One out of every five triplet births, 20% of all triplet births, will produce a child with a major handicap. And every other quadruplet birth, 50% of all quadruplet births, will produce a baby with the same. And in terms of mortality itself, these are deaths per 1,000 live births. Looking here at total infant mortality, an enormous number of babies who die, who are born prematurely, die within 1 year of birth. A total of almost 200 out of every 1,000 babies born from a triplet or greater pregnancy will die within 1 year of age, which is an almost 20-fold increase over the mortality of singleton pregnancies. The drama of these data is apparent in this graph. Infant death, stillbirth, and perinatal mortality increase geometrically from singleton births to twin births to higher order to triplet births and even higher. From a maternal point of view, complications of a multiple pregnancy include life-threatening conditions such as eclampsia, pulmonary embolism, and maternal hemorrhage, as well as other conditions listed here. 57%, more than half of women with triplet pregnancies, need to be hospitalized during the pregnancy prior to delivery. And compare this with only about 12% of women who have singleton pregnancies who need some sort of hospitalization prior to delivery. The economic consequences of multiple births can be staggering as well, because the management of multiple pregnancy often includes prolonged hospitalization of both the mother during the pregnancy as well as of the babies in the NICU, in the neonatal intensive care unit, after delivery. The healthcare costs are enormous. These costs can run as high as almost $300,000 for a quadruplet pregnancy, and they can cripple an individual couple. And of course, the psychological and social implications for the couple and for the children can be costly as well. The risk of maternal depression increases with the number of infants that are born, and pre-existing psychopathology in either parent can be aggravated. For the children, evidence suggests that language development may be impaired and that the incidence of reading difficulties and behavioral problems may be higher in children of multiple births. Socially, parents can feel isolated and overburdened and are stressed by lack of sleep and crowded living conditions and often need lots of extra help. So I hope by now we're all convinced of the problem, that multiple pregnancy is a problem, and that we really should do everything that we possibly can to prevent the initiation of such a pregnancy. And this includes doctors and patients being very careful and very, very conservative with fertility treatments and always reminding themselves, and I tell this to couples all the time, that in general, I would much rather their fertility attempt this month fail and have to be repeated next month than that this fertility attempt should lead to a triplet or a quadruplet pregnancy, which can give them lifelong tsaras. And this includes Rabbanim as well. Rabbanim really have to take these risks carefully into account when couples approach them to discuss, for example, the types of fertility treatments that they should undergo. Rabbanim often are a little bit reluctant, or it takes longer for a couple to get a psak that it's okay to proceed with IVF, when sometimes if we look at these data, we may realize that it might actually be a safer thing for couples to go through IVF. As much as we think of IVF as a more aggressive treatment, it's more controlled, and the risk of multiple pregnancy will be significantly less if performed appropriately. But okay, so now what do we do if, despite our best efforts at prevention, a couple does become pregnant with a high-order multiple pregnancy, which will happen? Medically, there are really two options. Either we can watch the pregnancy closely and intervene as warranted, or we can consider performing a multifetal pregnancy reduction. Multifetal pregnancy reduction is a technique whereby we bring about the demise of one or more of the fetuses in a multiple pregnancy with the intent to allow the pregnancy to continue and to deliver fewer infants with consequently lower risks of morbidity and mortality. The procedure itself is carried out under ultrasound guidance. The physician performing the procedure visualizes the fetus on ultrasound and passes a needle into the fetal heart, or more often into the thoracic cavity of the fetus. The physician then injects a bolus, an injection of potassium chloride, which is cardiotoxic. It's toxic to the heart, and it stops the heart within a very short period of time. The procedure can be done either by inserting a needle through the mother's abdomen. This is the transabdominal approach, which technically is very similar to an amniocentesis. Or it can be done transvaginally through the vaginal canal, which is similar in technique to the egg retrieval that's done for IVF. The decision as to which fetus or fetuses to reduce is usually made after a very careful pre-evaluation of the individual fetuses. And we use various testing modalities, such as nuchal translucency measurements and anatomical surveys to as extensive a degree as it's possible at that stage in the pregnancy, are used to assess each fetus for the presence of any major malformations or abnormalities. If all of the fetuses seem from these testing modalities to be normal, then the locations of the fetuses within the uterus are used to decide which one should be reduced or which ones should be reduced with the least chance of causing a problem to the others. If any fetus is found to have a major malformation or abnormality, then that fetus is the one reduced. This procedure can be risky in terms of the timing if it's done too early or too late in the pregnancy. The time period from 10 to 15 weeks gestational age, which is about 8 to 13 weeks from conception, seems to be the optimal time to perform the procedure, both from the point of view of minimizing the risk, as well as from the point of view of being able to obtain adequate fetal testing beforehand to be sure that we will not reduce a normal fetus and leave an abnormal fetus to continue. Fetal reduction certainly inheres certain risks, including the risks of bleeding and infection. The most devastating possible risk of a multifetal reduction is the loss of the entire pregnancy. This risk, the risk of losing the entire pregnancy, correlates with the number of fetuses reduced. In the hands of an experienced practitioner, the risks of miscarrying the pregnancy are about 3 to 5% when reducing from triplets to twins. This risk of losing the pregnancy is about 5 to 10% when reducing from quadruplets to twins, and about 10 to 25% when reducing from quintuplets or more to twins. In general, the risk of losing the pregnancy is approximately 5% or so per fetus reduced. Medically, the benefits of a fetal reduction lie in its ability to modify the risks of a high-order multiple pregnancy. The available data seem to show that multifetal reduction increases the duration of pregnancy, reduces the incidence of prematurity, increases birth weight of the fetuses when they're born, and also reduces neonatal mortality, infant death, and reduces maternal risks in the pregnancy as well. One of the concerns about performing multifetal pregnancy reduction has been that patients may feel guilty afterwards and perhaps might regret that they underwent the procedure altogether. In fact, in semi-structured interviews of a small number of women who had undergone multifetal reduction, but it's important to note that about one-third of these women reported feeling persistent guilt about going through the procedure about 1 year after the procedure. Although there have been studies that use standard psychological tests to look at these women at their emotional state after pregnancy reduction, and these studies have found no serious long-term psychological sequelae. There was a large study of 91 patients who had undergone fetal reduction, and that study reported that about 93% of the patients, almost all of them, said that they would make the same decision again to undergo a reduction again if need be. But nonetheless, the concern is a real one because this situation is really a unique situation in medicine. Here we have a husband and a wife who have been waiting for a pregnancy, desperately hoping for a pregnancy, and actively pursuing medical treatment, sometimes for a long time, in the pursuit of a pregnancy and towards the goal of achieving a pregnancy. And this couple now has achieved that pregnancy. They've achieved success, finally, in their medical treatment, but it's an excess of success. They have striven so long for fertility, and now they're confronted with a decision that, for the affected fetus, is really a decision of anti-fertility. And for a Jewish couple, this issue is layered with the strong Jewish value which is placed on fertility. And this value, of course, is clear throughout the Torah, in which fertility is consistently identified as a bracha. The psukim in Parshas Ekev promise a list of the good and generous things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God will do for us if we listen to him. And these psukim include the promise that Baruch Tiyeh Mikol Ha'amim Lo Yevecha Akar Va'akara, that we will be blessed above all people, we will not have among us any infertility. The very first words of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of God, to Adam HaRishon, to Adam, were Pru Urvu, be fruitful and multiply. This was his very first communication with humanity, not hello and welcome to the world, not let me introduce myself, I'm your creator. It was be fruitful, Pru Urvu. The Mishnah in Edios says that Brias Ha'olam, creation itself, was for the purpose of procreation. Lo Nivra Ha'olam Ela Lefiria Verivia. Hashem, in other words, created the world entirely for man to live within it, and only by reproducing can we live within it and thus fulfill the very purpose of creation. The directive of Pru Urvu, of be fruitful and multiply, as told to Adam and Chava in the first parak of Bereishis last week, is actually presented not in the form of a command, of a tzivui, but in the form of a bracha, of a blessing. Vayvarech osam Elokim, vayomer lohem Elokim, pru urvu umilu es haaretz vechivshuha. Hashem gives Adam and Chava the bracha that they should be very fertile and fill up the whole world. And sure enough, the bracha of fertility was fulfilled. Indeed, Adam and Chava turned out to be very fertile. Their first two pregnancies, in fact, the first two pregnancies of all mankind in the Torah, were both multiple pregnancies, one twin and one triplet. The Medrash says, Amrlei Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha alu lamata shnayim v'yardu shiva kayin usumaso v'hevel ushtesu umosav. The Medrash says that the first pregnancy, Kayin, the oldest son of Adam and Eve, was born together with a twin sister, and Hevel, the second child, was born as a triplet pregnancy together with two sisters. And many people in Tanakh, many people in the Bible, were products of multiple pregnancies, some that we see from the psukim themselves, and some that we see midivrei chazal. Besides for Kayin and Hevel, whom we just saw were products of multiple pregnancies, this list includes Rachel and Leah, whom the Medrash says were twins, based on calculations of their ages. Nimtzu'u Rachel v'Leah nasu'u b'nos kafbeis kafbeis shahayu tu'umos. The Medrash calculates that they were twins. Yaakov and Esav, we know we're twins. And by the way, incidentally, we usually think of Yaakov and Esav as fraternal twins, but I really often wonder if maybe they were actually identical twins who suffered from a condition known as the twin-twin transfusion syndrome, where one twin often comes out ruddy and large and the other twin comes out pale and small. The Shvatim, the sons of Yaakov, were twins, according to one opinion in the Medrash, as quoted by Rashi on the pasuk of Vayakumu Chobonav Chobonosav L'Nachamo. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, quotes Rabbi Yehuda, saying, Achayos ta'omos noldu im kol shevet v'shevet, that each son of Yaakov was born together with a twin sister. And according to the Gemara in Bava Basra and the Medrash and the Bereishis Rabbah, Yaakov's daughter Dina had a twin sister as well, and Binyamin was actually a triplet who was born together with two sisters. The psukim themselves, of course, tell us the story of the delivery of Yehuda's two sons, twin sons, Peretz and Zerach. And the Medrash, brought down by Rashi, highlights the high fertility of Jewish couples while we were slaves in Mitzrayim, while we were slaves in Egypt. Based on the pasuk of Bnei Yisrael, Paru v'yishratzu v'yirbu v'yatzmu b'meod me'od, Rashi says, Shahayu yoldo shisha b'cheres echad, that many Jewish women conceived six children simultaneously. Now we assume that these widespread high-order multiple pregnancies in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, had good outcomes. Hashem was obviously enhancing our fertility in Mitzrayim to the degree that sextuplets seemed to become almost physiologic, really part of the human condition for Jewish couples living in Mitzrayim at the time. But now, though, in the year 5768, in the year Tavshin Samaches, 2007, we saw that high-order multiple pregnancies carry significant risks of morbidity and mortality both to the mother as well as to the fetuses. And medically now, we have available to us the technique of multifetal pregnancy reduction. So the question is, how does halacha approach this technique? And really, any discussion of multifetal reduction in halacha has to begin with a discussion of the overall isser, the overall prohibition of feticide. After all, if terminating fetal life were considered to be okay in halacha, then multifetal pregnancy reduction would be no issue at all. But clearly, this is not the case. I'm not going to spend much time on the topic of abortion in halacha because this is its own separate and extensive topic. But in brief, feticide in general is prohibited in halacha. And the basic source for this prohibition is the pasuk that we just learned yesterday in Parshas Noach. Shofeich dam ha'adam ba'adam, damo yishafeich, ki betzelem elokim asa'es ha'adam. The pasuk says that whoever sheds the blood of a person within a person, his blood shall be shed, for God, for Hashem, made man in his image. This pasuk teaches us that it's prohibited for a non-Jewish person to kill a fetus in utero, and indeed such an act is punishable by capital punishment, by death. For Yisrael, for a Jew, the basis for the isser of abortion rests in a Gemara in Sanhedrin. Amar Mar, kol mitzvah shenemra livnei Noach v'nishneis b'sinai lezeh ulezeh nemra. The Gemara gives us a principle, sets forth a principle that any mitzvah which was originally said to b'nei Noach and then repeated to us at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai, was meant for both Jew and non-Jew. How do we know this, though, asks the Gemara. Adarava, midinishneis b'sinai liyisrael nemra v'lo livnei Noach. The Gemara says we might think just the opposite. If a mitzvah is restated at Har Sinai, then maybe that now means that it applies only to us and no longer to B'nai Noach. And answers the Gemara, mean to Isni Avodazara B'Sinai, Va'ashkechan Da'onash Nochri Ilava, Shma Mina Lezeh Ulezeh Nemra. The Gemara says that we know our principle from the prohibition, from the mitzvah of not worshiping Avodazara. This was stated at Har Sinai, and yet clearly B'nai Noach are obligated in it as well. This is one of the Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach. And clearly then a mitzvah that's repeated at Har Sinai is meant for everyone. And the opposite principle is true as well, says the Gemara. Livnei Noach v'lo nishneis b'Sinai li Yisrael nemra v'lo livnei Noach, that any mitzvah which was originally said to B'nai Noach and then not restated at Har Sinai is meant just for us and not just for Jewish people and not for non-Jewish people. But again, though, the Gemara asks, we might think just the opposite. Adarabba, midelo nishneis b'Sinai livnei Noach nemra v'lo li Yisrael. We might actually think that if a mitzvah is not restated at Har Sinai, then presumably that's because it continues to be meant for B'nai Noach, for all non-Jewish people, and in fact not for the Jewish people who just received the Torah and the obligations at Har Sinai. But no, answers the Gemara. Leka midam de Yisrael shari ulinachri asur. The Gemara says we cannot entertain the notion of something being commanded to B'nai Noach, to non-Jewish people, and not to Jewish people. It's the Gemara is setting forth the principle here that for any specific situation, if a non-Jewish person is held responsible for a particular action, then certainly so must a Jewish person be held responsible for that action. There can be nothing which would be prohibited for a non-Jew but permitted to a Jew. Tosfos there in Sanhedrin and in Chulin also says that although a Jew who kills a fetus is not liable for a death penalty, as a non-Jewish person who kills a fetus is, it is still forbidden for a Jew to abort a fetus, just as it is for non-Jews. And along those same lines, many Rishonim actually feel that for a Jewish person, there is an Isser Doraisa, there is a biblical prohibition to kill a fetus, just as the Pasuk Shofeich Dam Ha'adam that we saw explicitly says there is for a Ben Noach. The concept of Rodef plays a very large role in any discussion about multifetal pregnancy reduction. A rodef literally means a pursuer and refers to a person who is pursuing another person to kill him, who's chasing after someone to kill that person. And the source for this concept is a verse, a pasuk in Mishpatim, which says, "Im b'machteres yimatzei haganov v'hukav ames ein lo damim." If a thief shall be found breaking into someone's house and is attacked and killed, there shall be no liability on his account. The Gemara learns out from this pasuk that imba lehargecha hashkem lehargo. If someone is coming after you to kill you, you have the right to slay him first to prevent him from killing you. The Rambam in Hilchos Rotzeach discusses the permissibility and in fact the obligation to kill a rodef, to kill a pursuer. in order to save the life of the nirdaf, to save the life of the person who's being pursued. In the course of this discussion, the Rambam says, Harezu mitzvas lo sa'ase shelo lachus al nefesh harodev, leficha choru chachamim, sheha'ubra shehi maksha leled, mutar lachto cha'ubar b'me'eha, bein b'sam, bein b'yad, mipnei shehu kirodev achareha laharga. If a pregnant woman's life is threatened during childbirth, it's permitted to kill the fetus in her womb because the fetus is considered to be pursuing her to kill her. The Rambam says that because one is allowed and even obligated to kill a rodef, to kill a pursuer, therefore one is allowed to abort a fetus in order to save the life of a mother. Now, the principle of rodef can be applied to the situation of a multiple pregnancy, and particularly a high-order multiple pregnancy, in that each fetus can be considered to be a rodef, a pursuer, either vis-a-vis the mother as the nirdaf, as the one who's in danger, who's being pursued, or vis-a-vis its siblings, the other fetuses in the uterus, as the ones whose lives are being threatened. If we're talking about the fetus as a rodef with regard to the mother, the issue is really an easy one. There would be no question at all that we could perform a multifetal reduction to the point where the mother's life is no longer at risk. However, this is rarely such a clear-cut issue. The maternal risks in a high-order multiple pregnancy are significant, as we discussed earlier, and they can be life-threatening as well, as we mentioned. But for all women, really, if you think about it, pregnancy is a state of higher risk than non-pregnancy. And yet no one would argue that pregnancy is not a physiologic state and not a normal part of the human condition. No one would argue that a singleton pregnancy, that a singleton fetus in a normal single pregnancy can be considered to be a rodef of his mother, even though the mother's life is certainly more at risk because of that fetus than if she had not been pregnant at all. Perhaps twins aren't also part of the normal human condition, but certainly sextuplets are not. So where exactly do we draw the line? It's not an easy question. When does a fetus become a rodef with regard to the mother? When it's part of a triplet pregnancy, a quadruplet pregnancy? This question really probably needs to be individualized because for some women, for example, women with pre-existing medical conditions like cardiovascular disease or pulmonary disease, the threat to the lives of these women with even a twin pregnancy or sometimes even with a pregnancy altogether, with even a singleton pregnancy, might be enough to define the fetus as a rodef, as a pursuer, and to thus allow its life to be terminated in order to eliminate the threat to the mother's life that the fetus is creating. More complicated than the question of the fetus's status of rodef with regard to the mother is the question of whether each fetus can be considered a rodef, a pursuer, with regard to its siblings. Medically, we saw that in a multiple pregnancy, each fetus has a lower chance of survival and sometimes even a probability of death because of the multiple nature of the pregnancy, which really means because of the presence of all the other fetuses in the uterus. Now, in that same halacha, in Hilchos Rotzeach, the Rambam continues to say that while it's okay to kill a fetus during childbirth, during a difficult childbirth, to save the life of the mother, once the fetal head has delivered, once the baby is partially born, it is no longer permissible to do so. Ve'im yishahotzi rosho ein nogimbo. We can no longer touch the fetus. And why at that point, says the Rambam, is the fetus, the baby, not considered to be a rodef, pursuing the mother if the mother's possibly going to die right there with the fetus partially born? Because the Rambam says, Zehu tivo shel olam. This is the natural order of the world. Childbirth is a natural process, and unlike a thief who breaks into your house to kill you, a baby being born cannot be considered to be its mother's pursuer. This is a physiologic pursuit, and it's not within the umbrella of rodef. And this concept is based on a Gemara in Sanhedrin, which asks that same question, V'amai rodefu, talking about the same case, why isn't the fetus who is being born, who is partially born, still considered to be a rodef? Why are we no longer allowed to kill that fetus in order to save the mother? And the Gemara answers, Shani hasam de mishmaya karadfila, because heaven is the pursuer, it's shamayim that's threatening the mother, and it's not the fetus. Rav Chaim Brisker, by the way, in his Chidushim, addresses an obvious question on the Rambam. Well, then, why is the fetus who is not yet born allowed to be killed for being defined as a rodef if he's putting the mother's life at risk. If it's shamayim, that's the rodef. If heaven is the pursuer for the fetus whose head is already emerged, who's partially born, if that's a natural phenomenon, then why don't we say the same thing for a fetus in utero and consider shamayim to be the rodef rather than this innocent fetus? And in his conclusion, Rav Chaim invokes a principle from the Mishnah in Ahalos that describes this case of the fetus in utero, which is threatening the mother's life. The Mishnah says, "Ha'isha shehi maksha leleid mechatchim es havlad b'me'eha u'motzin oso evarim evarim b'pnei shechayeha kodmin l'chayav." The life of the fetus in utero is not equal to the life of the mother, says the Mishnah. And this, Rav Chaim feels, is the cornerstone of the Rambam's reasoning and the differentiation between a fetus in utero and a fetus which is partially born. Now, interestingly, the Yerushalmi brings a different reason for why we do not kill the fetus in order to save the mother once the fetus is partially born. We just saw in the Bavli in Sanhedrin and brought down by the Rambam that since Shamayim is the pursuer, since it's a physiologic pursuit, the fetus is not a rodef, and we cannot kill the fetus. The Yerushalmi gives a different reason. The Yerushalmi says, She'ein at yodea mi horeg es mi. The mother and the fetus are simultaneously endangering one another, and it's therefore impossible for us to determine who is the rodef and who is the nirdef, who is the pursuer and who is being pursued. That's what the Yerushalmi says. So we have two possible reasons for why we cannot consider a baby who's being born, who's partially born, as a rodef of its mother. According to the Bavli, we saw Mishmaya Karadfila, that it's a natural phenomenon, a pursuit min shamayim. And according to the Yerushalmi, She'einat yodea miho regas mi, it's because the mother and the baby are simultaneously rodef and nirdef. Now, regardless of which of these principles we support, their application to multifetal pregnancy reduction would seem to leave very little room to allow the procedure from the point of view of the other fetuses, of each fetus being a rodef for the other fetuses. Because if you're the Bavli, each fetus cannot be defined as a rodef because it's a physiologic pursuit. It's a pursuit min hashamayim. And if you hold like the Yerushalmi, each fetus is simultaneously a rodef and a nirdef, a pursuer and pursued vis-a-vis the other fetuses, and therefore we may not be able to kill any one fetus. Put that aside for now. Another crucial set of halachos that comes into play with regard to multifetal pregnancy reduction is the permissibility of sacrificing one life to save another, the concept of mesira, of handing somebody over to be killed in order to save other lives. The Rambam in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah says, based on a Mishnah in the 8th parak of Trumos, he says, Nashim sha'amru lohem ovdei kochavim tenu lanu achas miken v'nitma osa v'im lav nitma es kulchem yitmu kulan v'al yimsru lohem nefesh achas miyisrael. If a group of women were informed by idolaters that one of them must be handed over to be defiled, or otherwise they will all be defiled, they must all submit rather than hand over a single Jew. Similarly, continues the Rambam, V'chein, im amru lahem ovdei kochavim, tenu lanu echad mikem v'nahargenu, v'im lav naharo kulchem, yehargu kulam v'al yimsiru lahem nefesh achas miyisrael. If the idolaters said to this group that they will kill everyone unless one person from the group is handed over to be killed, everybody must submit to death rather than hand over a single Jew. This is the Rambam. However, continues the Rambam, v'im yichaduhu lahem v'amru tenu lanu ploni o naharoges kulchem, im hayamechuyav misa kesheva ben bichri yitnu oso lahem, v'im eino chayev misa, yehargu kulan va'al yimsiru lahem nefesh achas miyisrael. If the idolaters, says the Rambam, specify the person, name the person whom they insist be handed over to be killed, then that person can be handed over only if that person is already deserving of death, is already chayev misa, like Sheva ben Bichri. If he is not deserving of death, then all must submit to death rather than hand over a single person to be killed. And this story with Sheva ben Bichri is brought down in the 20th parak of Shmuel Beis. Sheva ben Bichri was a leader who revolted against David HaMelech, and he took refuge in a city of Avela Beis Macha. Yoav ben Tzruya, David HaMelech's general, surrounded the city and threatened to kill everyone unless Sheva ben Bichri was handed over. An Isha Chachama, a wise woman, whom the Medrash actually identifies as Yaakov's grandson, Serach, granddaughter, Serach Bas Asher, convinced the people in the city to kill Sheva and to deliver his head to Yoav, thus saving the city. Because Sheva ben Bichri was a Morid b'Malchus, he was deserving of death. He was Chayev Misa because he was guilty of treason, which is a capital crime. And therefore, the Isha Chachama, the wise woman, and the people in the town were halachically correct to hand him over rather than to all submit to death at the hands of Yoav. The Kesef Mishnah on this Rambam quotes the following question from the Ramach. The Gemara in Psachim, Daf Chafei Amud Beis, says that the halacha of Yehareg Va'al Yavar for murder, the halacha that a person should allow himself to be killed rather than murder another person, is predicated in logic, in Svara. Ushvichas damim gufei minolan, Svarahu, mai chazis de dama didach sumak tvei. It's illogical for a person to say, my blood is redder than yours, so therefore I'm going to kill you rather than be killed myself. Everybody's life holds equal value. Everybody's blood is equally red, and that's why we can never choose, we can never kill somebody else in order to save our own lives. And therefore, asks the Ramach, in the case where the Ovdei Kochavim are demanding that a Jew be handed over or else everyone will be killed, surely we should use logic, we should use a svara there as well. We should recognize that the one person who would be handed over in that case will be killed regardless. He'll be killed either alone if he's handed over, or he'll be killed together with everybody else if he's not handed over, and when the pillagers come in and annihilate the town. So the svara, the logic of one, no one person's blood being redder than anybody else's, should not apply to somebody who will be killed regardless. Better he be killed alone than be killed together with everybody else. But the Kesef Mishnah answers that the logic of Dama Didach Sumak Tvei, the logic of no one's blood being redder than anyone else's, still applies. Because since the Ovdei Kochavim, since these evil people are not specifying any particular person in this case by name, anyone chosen to be handed over to them can argue, why are you choosing me? Go choose him. Why do you think that his blood is redder than mine, that you're choosing me over him? So the logic still applies, and therefore we cannot really choose anybody to hand over to save the entire town. The Kesef Mishnah then asks the opposite question. Well, the svara, the logic of no one's blood being redder than anyone else, of Dama Didach Sumak Tvei, should not apply to the case of a specific person named by the marauders. Kasha, Da'amar Sha'afal Pisha Yichaduhu Lahem, Im Eino Chayev Misa Loyim Siruhu, Da'haleka Hacha Svara Damai Chazis de Dama Didach Sumak Tvei, Sha'arei Hu Vehem Neharagim, Im Loyim Siruhu. The Rambam had said that when a specific person is named, he can only be handed over if he's Chayev Misa, if he's condemned already to death. But if he's not on death row, then we cannot hand him over. But why not, says the Kesef Mishnah? Because this person cannot protest, why choose me, choose somebody else, why is his blood redder than mine? Because he was named. He's the poor person that was named by the gang of marauders to be handed over. So since he's going to be killed anyway, either alone or together with everyone else, he should be able to be handed over in order to save everyone. And answers the Kesef Mishnah, V'yefshar lomar, Shemasha kasav de b'shvichas damim svarahu, eino ikar hata'am, de kabbala haisa b'yadam de shvichas damim yeharig v'al yavar, ela shenasnu ta'am misvara lehecha de shayach. Aval inachinami, de afilu hecha de lo shayach haitaima, havidina hachi de yeharig v'al yavar. The Kesef Mishnah says that the logic of no one's blood being redder than anyone else's is not the real basis for the principle that a person must allow himself to be killed rather than murder anybody else, for the principle of Yehareg Va'al Yavar. Really, this principle is a tradition. It's a Kabbalah. We apply the logic of Dama Didach, of no one's blood being redder than anyone else's, when it's applicable. But even when it's not applicable, the halachic principle still applies. No matter what, by tradition leading all the way up to Har Sinai, a person still cannot murder someone to save himself from death. And this issue might actually form the basis of a machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, which is brought down in the Yerushalmi in Trumos. The Yerushalmi says, Tani, Sios b'nei adam shahayu mahalchin baderech, pagu lohem goyim v'amru, tenu lanu echad mikem v'naharogo so, v'im lav harei onu horgim es kulchem. Afilu kulan neharogim lo yimsura nefesh achas mi Yisrael. Yichadu lahen echad, kegon Sheva ben Bichri, Yimsiru oso ve'al yehargu, Amar Rav Shimon ben Lakish, Vehu sheyehe chayev misa kesheva ben Bichri, Rabbi Yochanan amar afal pi she'eno chayev misa kesheva ben Bichri. This disagreement arises in a case where the brigands specify a particular individual. They name a person who is to be handed over to die, or else everybody will be killed. This specific person is not on death row. He's not chayev misa. Rabbi Yochanan says we hand the person over, and Reish Lakish says that we cannot hand the person over. According to Reish Lakish, the only situation in which we are permitted to hand the person over in this case is when a particular person is named and that named person is on death row, is chayev misa. The Rambam, we saw, clearly rules like Reish Lakish. That's exactly what we saw the Rambam, say before. And I would suggest that perhaps this machlokes can actually be understood as relating to the very nature, the basis of Yehareg Va'al Yavar for murder, as we saw in the discussion in the Kesef Mishnah. Maybe what Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish are actually arguing about is whether Yehareg Va'al Yavar, the concept of not being allowed to kill somebody else in order to save yourself, is based entirely on logic, or whether it's based on tradition, on a Kabbalah, that we use logic to help explain, but it's really a tradition. Maybe Rabbi Yochanan says that it's really entirely based on svara. And therefore, even when the specified person is not on death row, he can still be handed over because he's going to be killed anyway. And since his name was specified, the poor person cannot protest, why choose me, choose somebody else, my blood is just as red as anybody else's, because he was named. It's a shame, but he was named. And maybe Reish Lakish's position is that Yehareg Va'al Yavar for murder is based not on Svara, but on Kabbalah. And if it's based on tradition, then in the case where the specified person is not on death row, he cannot be handed over no matter what. And don't confuse us with logic. Even if it's illogical, it's a tradition. According to Reish Lakish, maybe the only time that there is no Kabbalah for Yehareg Va'al Yavar is when the person is a dead man walking. When the specified person is chayav misa and he's on death row for a capital crime, maybe perhaps then Yehareg Va'al Yavar doesn't apply because maybe he's considered already a harug and it's not an issue. But the Lecha Mishnah disagrees with the Kesef Mishnah's assertion that Yehareg Va'al Yavar is based on Kabbalah and not on Svara, on tradition and not on logic. The Lecha Mishnah says that actually it's based on Svara. The reason why you cannot, if somebody holds a gun to your head and says, kill him or I'll kill you, the reason why you cannot go and kill the other person to save yourself is because of the logic of Dama Didach, of My Chazis, the Dama Didach Sumak Tvei, that everybody's blood is as red as everybody else's. And therefore, in a case where the desperados specify the victim that they want to be handed over for death, he can be handed over because he cannot argue, why choose me, choose someone else, because he was specifically named. When the Rambam explains that a specified person is not handed over if he's not chayav misa, if he's not on death row, the Lecha Mishnah explains, v'efshar lomar bedochak, dehasa mayri sheyesh lahem shum tzad lehi malet. The Lecha Mishnah says this refers only to a specific situation where the specified victim, the person who's named, actually has a chance at escape, a chance at escaping from the city when the gangsters come in to kill everyone else. In such a case, the logic of no one's blood being redder than anyone else's does apply. The Lecha Mishnah concedes that this is difficult to read into the Rambam because the Rambam does not explicitly say anything about a possible escape clause. But nevertheless, this is how he explains the Rambam. And now back to the Machlokas that we saw in the Yerushalmi before, between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. According to the Lecha Mishnah's understanding of this machlokas, of the Rambam, this machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish can only arise when the possibility exists that the specified person might be able to be saved, might be able to escape. Because if the specified individual cannot possibly be saved, if there's no escape for him no matter what, then even Reish Lakish would agree that he can be handed over, because according to the Lecha Mishnah, everybody agrees that Yehareg Va'al Yavar is based on Svara, that no one can ever murder someone to prevent his own death, because logically no one's blood is redder than anyone else's. But when the possibility exists that the specified person can be saved, can escape from his potential doom, Rabbi Yochanan says he can nonetheless still be handed over, and in that case, Reish Lakish says, no, he cannot. So then what would be the basis of this machlokas? And the Chazon Ish actually suggests that the underlying machlokas here between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish might actually be about Rodef. And this is where I told you to put Rodef aside, for now we're going to come back to Rodef, to the concept of a pursuer. Perhaps the reason why Rabbi Yochanan says that the specified person is handed over, despite the fact that there is a possibility of his being saved, is because the named person is a rodef. This isn't about Yehari Val Yavar. This is about a rodef. He's a pursuer. Since the lives of everyone else in town are in danger because of this person, and everyone will be killed if he is not handed over, then he becomes a rodef, and he can be given over to his death. Whereas, according to Reish Lakish, this poor, innocent person who is being unfairly singled out by the hooligans, and by the way, who is not even on death row, and who might even have a chance at escaping, cannot possibly be defined as a rodef, as someone who is pursuing someone else to kill him, and so therefore, he cannot be handed over. And in fact, perhaps this machlokas is really a fundamental machlokas about the nature of rodef altogether. Is a rodef someone who pursues a fellow man with a nefarious intent, with the intent to cause criminal harm and inflict damage on him? Or is a rodef defined as any person whose actions, however pure, and perhaps whose very existence, puts someone else's life at risk? Does a rodef have a component of consciousness, of a degraded morality? Or is it just the fact of someone else's life being at risk on the account of this person? Is a rodef defined by contextual evidence? If the context of a person's actions or existence is such that he puts someone else's life at risk, even unwittingly, then does that make the person a rodef? Or is a rodef defined by intentional evidence? If the person is putting someone else at risk with the intent of putting him at risk, of causing him harm, then and only then is he defined as a rodef. And perhaps this is exactly the machlokas here. Maybe Rabbi Yochanan thinks that the definition of pursuit is contextual. It depends on the context of what's going on, with no regard for any moral iniquity. In our case, the fact is that this specified person, albeit through no fault of his own at all, is threatening the lives of the entire town just by his existence. And therefore, this unfortunate person is defined as a rodef, and therefore, for that reason, we can hand him over. And maybe Reish Lakish disagrees. And maybe Reish Lakish feels that pursuit implies iniquity. And to be a rodef, to be defined as someone pursuing someone else, we actually have to look at the intent of the pursuer. And that's why, in our case, this specified person, who is guilty of no crime and is not himself intending to kill anyone or threaten anyone, cannot be defined as a rodef, as a pursuer, according to Reish Lakish, which means, if we carry this through, that from a rodef point of view, we cannot hand him over. And from the point of view of Mesira, of Yeharig Val Yavar, we cannot hand him over either, because in this case, we said, according to the Lecha Mishnah's view at least, that there is a possibility of escape. And since Yeharig Val Yavar is based on logic, is based on Svara, this person can argue, why hand me over? Hand someone else over. His blood is not any redder than mine is. And even though his name was specified by the bandits, he would not necessarily die if he wasn't handed over, because he might be able to escape. So Reish Lakish would say basically that we cannot hand him over either from a rodef perspective or from a Yehareg Val Yavar perspective. And this understanding of the machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish might actually be related to a machlokas that we saw earlier between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi as to why a fetus who is partially born is not defined as a rodef to allow us to kill it in order to save the life of the mother. The Bavli, we saw, says that the reason for this is Mishmaya Karadfila, that the heavens are doing the pursuing and not the fetus. The Yerushalmi said that the reason is She'enat Yodea Mihoregis Mi, that the mother and the fetus are both threatening each other's lives simultaneously, and therefore we cannot determine who is the rodef and who is the near-deaf. And now maybe we can understand this machlokas too as relating to the definition of a rodef. The Bavli seems to incorporate the intent, the morality of the pursuer, into the fundamental definition of rodef. That's why a fetus cannot be a rodef, because the innocent fetus has no conscious intent to harm his mother. It's a physiologic threat. It's a threat from Shemayim, but the fetus is no criminal. And that's why we cannot kill the partially born fetus in order to save the mother. And perhaps the Yerushalmi could not use this reason of Mishmaya Karad Fila in order to explain why the fetus is not a rodef, because according to the Yerushalmi, it's the context that defines a rodef without any regard to the intent. So even though the fetus has no moral viciousness about him and has no conscious plan to harm his mother, this is not what would prevent him from being defined as a rodef, as a pursuer. If the very fact of the fetus's existence threatens the mother, then this context would make the fetus a rodef. And that's why the Yerushalmi had to give a different explanation for why we do not kill the fetus at this point. Because yes, he's a rodef, but so is the mother vis-a-vis him. And since we cannot clearly identify who's the rodef and who's the nirdaf, we do not have a license to kill. It turns out that according to this, the Yerushalmi and Rabbi Yochanan look at the context of the situation in order to define a rodef, while the Bavli and Reish Lakish are looking at the intent of the pursuer. And by the way, this also might explain why the Rambam takes a position like Reish Lakish, saying that we cannot hand over the specified individual who is not Chayiv Misa, who is not on death row, where usually we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan in a machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Maybe the Rambam is following Reish Lakish here because Reish Lakish is representing the approach of the Bavli in opposition to the Yerushalmi. From a practical point of view, both of these concepts of Rodef and of Mesira, Yeharig Val Yavar, come into play when evaluating the technique of multifetal pregnancy reduction. Whether multifetal reduction should be permitted or not may likely depend on the machlokas between the Kesef Mishnah and the Lechem Mishnah that we've been discussing. According to the Lechem Mishnah, the Rambam, like Reish Lakish, says that if a specified person is asked to be handed over to a gang of marauders to be killed, or else everyone else will be killed, even if that person is not Chayiv Misa, we hand the person over to be killed. And why? Because Yeharig Val Yavar is dependent on Svara, on the logic of everyone's blood being equally red. And if the logic doesn't apply, as it doesn't in a case of the specified individual, then Yeharig Val Yavar doesn't apply, and we can kill someone in order to save ourselves. Conceptually, according to this approach, it might be permissible to kill a fetus in utero. This might end up being okay in a situation where all the fetuses will surely die if one is not reduced, and medically we do specify which fetus needs to be reduced to save the rest based on how normal each fetus looks and what the location of the fetus is within the uterus, as we saw before. However, we do have to keep in mind that if there is a possibility that the fetus to be reduced could have survived, then the case becomes analogous to the case of the specified individual who's not Chayav Misa with a possibility of escape. And in this case, the logic of Dama Didach Sumak Tvei, that everyone's blood is equally red, does apply. And so according to the Rambam, like Reish Lakish and like the Bavli, the fetus might not be considered a rodef because it lacks malicious intent, and therefore we might not be permitted to reduce it. Now, how to quantify the possibility of escape is a whole different story, and so I wrote here chance or probability of escape. If there is a remote possibility of fetal survival, does that prevent us from reducing? Does it have to be a probability of survival, a more than 50% chance, in order to keep us from using the logic of Dama Didach, of everyone's blood being equally red? If, on the other hand, and those are really open questions, if, on the other hand, though, we hold, like the Kesef Mishnah, that Yeharig Val Yavar is based on Kabbalah, on tradition, and not on Svara, then it would seem that we should not be permitted to reduce a fetus at all, really, from a Mesira point of view. Even if all would die, if one is not killed, we cannot deliver someone to his death, period, logic notwithstanding, unless perhaps the fetus has a gross abnormality, which will lead to its death. In which case, maybe we can argue that this fetus is actually like the specified person who is Chayav Misa, who is on death row, whom the Rambam said that we may hand over. Maybe the abnormal fetus who's doomed to die, maybe that abnormal fetus is in the same category of being Chayav Misa, and in such a case, maybe the multifetal reduction would be permissible. However, even according to the Kesef Mishnah, there may actually be room for leniency with regard to killing even a normal fetus. Yes, Yeharig Val Yavar is based on Kabbalah. It's based on tradition and not logic. And therefore, even if all the inhabitants of a city or of a uterus were to be killed, unless a specified individual is handed over for death, we're still not permitted to hand him over. But the Minchas Chinuch suggests that Yeharig Val Yavar might not at all apply to a fetus. Aval ubar lo shayach mai chazis ki lo havi nefesh rak haTorah asra kmo iser acher aval lo havi shvichas damim. The Minchas Chinuch suggests that because there is no capital punishment for the killing of a fetus by a Jew, killing a fetus is less severe than killing a born baby. And indeed, said the Minchas Chinuch, Dama Didach is Sumak Tfei. A fetus's blood, a postnatal life blood, a blood of somebody being born, is indeed redder than the blood of a fetus because of the fact of the difference of their punishments, because the fetus carries with it a monetary punishment for being killed, while a born person carries a capital punishment for being killed. And therefore, says the Minchas Chinuch, if one of these gangsters says to a Jew, kill that fetus or I will kill you, the Jew may kill the fetus in order to save his own life. And says the Minchas Chinuch, even if Yehorig Val Yavar is based on Kabbalah, is based on tradition rather than logic, still it would not apply to a fetus because it only applies to a situation of murder where the punishment is death. Because even for those, he says, like the Kesef Mishnah, who say that it's based on Kabbalah, the Kabbalah is rooted in the logic of Dama Didach. The Kabbalah is rooted in the logic, the tradition is rooted in the logic of no one's blood being redder than anyone else. Just that once we determine logically that a given life, that anyone's life has the same infinite value, then that's when the tradition kicks in and says that everybody's life has the same infinite value and is equally red. And even in a situation where the logic cannot be applied because, for example, that person was specified by name and is going to die anyway for sure, still that person's life has the same infinite value that we already determined it has, and the Kabbalah of Yehorig Val Yavar prevents us from killing him even to save many others. But for a fetus where the punishment is less severe, clearly fetal life, however important, has less value. It's a drop less than infinity, or a little bit of a different value than the life of someone who is born already. And so if there's never the logic of Dama Didach, if you can never argue for a fetus that the fetus's blood is equally red to anybody else who's born, then the Kabbalah of Yehorig Val Yavar never takes effect, and the fetus can be killed to save even another fetus because there's no Yehorig Val Yavar for a fetus. This is the Minchas Chinuch. Now, various Rabbanim and Poskim have written and spoken about the issue of multifetal reduction from a practical halacha point of view, and I'd just like to briefly outline some of what they have said. Rav Eliezer Waldenberg Zatzal wrote about the issue in a tshuva that he printed in the 20th volume of his responsa, the Tzitz Eliezer, in which he also quotes the opinion of Rav Yosef Elyashiv. Rav Waldenberg was dealing with a question about doing a reduction for a quadruplet pregnancy. He writes, Nira lefi ani vastati lahalacha shem mutter lahamis ubar echad kidei lahatzil al yedei kach chaye yeser shloshes haubrim asher kol echad mehem hu bevchina shel rodev. He says, in other words, he allows reduction of one fetus to reduce from a quadruplet pregnancy to a triplet pregnancy because each fetus, he says, is considered to be a rodef with regard to the others. He also says that he heard that Rav Eliashiv was asked the same question and answered in the same fashion, Sipruli ki es ha-she'ilah amura holchulish ol gamli didi ha-gon Rav Yosef Shalom Eliashiv ve-heshiv gamkein lahatir. Rav Eliashiv said the same thing. And I myself actually had a personal communication with Rav Eliashiv regarding the case of a 21-year-old frum woman who was anovulatory. She did not ovulate. And I treated her with injectable gonadotropin hormones in order to induce ovulation. She produced three eggs. She ovulated three eggs, and each one took, basically. She had a triplet pregnancy. Not only that, but one of the embryos actually split into monozygotic twins, into identical twins. So on ultrasound, I saw three pregnancy sacs, one of which contained two fetuses, and the other two of which contained one fetus each for a total of four fetuses. Now, given the fact that identical twins are risky in and of themselves, it didn't seem to make medical sense to me to think about reducing one of the two non-identical twins, leaving the two identical twins and one other fetus. And it certainly didn't make sense to reduce one of the identical twins because the likelihood is that the other twin would not survive if you kill one of the identical twins, and they likely would take the entire pregnancy with them. So the question posed to Rav Eliashiv was whether it's actually permissible to reduce the quadruplet pregnancy not to a triplet pregnancy, as he had previously answered in, as quoted in the Tzitz Eliezer, but actually to a twin pregnancy by reducing the identical twins. And Revel Yashiv said, he told us, that it's okay to reduce the identical twins if and only if the chances of fetal survival without the reduction were less than 50%. That's what he told me. He did not consider morbidity or major disability to be a factor in the discussion at all, only mortality, and only if there was a probability of mortality, a greater than 50% chance of death of each of the fetuses without the reduction. And in this case, the perinatologists were pretty much uniformly in agreement that the chances of fetal or infant death of each fetus were at least that high. So we actually did terminate the lives of those identical twins. And the end of the story, by the way, with this particular couple, is that this lovely couple underwent their multifetal reduction at 12 weeks, at which we reduced the identical twins, leaving male and female twins. Somewhere around the second trimester, the female started to develop an intrauterine growth restriction, started to lag in its growth. The woman, the wife was hospitalized at about 20 weeks pregnancy for preeclampsia, and she was observed about a week later at 30 weeks. She went into preterm labor, which was not able to be stopped. She had an emergency cesarean delivery at full dilatation of her twins. The girl was indeed small. She weighed 1 pound and 2 ounces, and the boy weighed about 3 pounds. The girl tragically died in the NICU in the hospital. The boy was released from the hospital at 7 weeks of age, and he's now alive, thank God, and healthy at 8 months old. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach Zatzal, as quoted by Dr. Avraham Avraham in the Nishmas Avraham, permits the reduction of either one or two fetuses in a quadruplet pregnancy in a specific case he was asked about where the mother had a small pelvis. Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, who's the son-in-law of Rav Yosef Elyashiv and the Rav of the Ramat El-Hanan neighborhood in Bnei Brak, allows multifetal reduction. He says that since a fetus is not considered to be alive, and since without the reduction, the fetuses will be non-viable, therefore reducing is not an act of murder, but is actually an act of hatsala for the remaining fetuses to establish their future viability. In fact, Rav Zilberstein suggests that multifetal reduction is actually a misnomer. It's not a good term. The technique should rather be called multifetal preservation rather than a multifetal reduction. It's not that we're reducing one fetus, but that we're preserving the others. And he feels that the physician should be the one to decide how many fetuses to reduce based on the statistical probabilities of survival. But Rav Zilberstein's heter is predicated on a reality that none of the fetuses would survive if the reduction were not done. And Rav Zilberstein, by the way, also says that the physician should not directly kill the fetus, but should do so in a more indirect way, a kind of a grumma way. And he actually addresses that a little bit. He says that the lethal injection of a toxic solution, like a concentrated salt solution, or presumably like the potassium chloride that we often use, he feels satisfies this recommendation. Rav Chaim David Halevi Zatzal, who was the former Sephardic chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, wrote that although abortion is murder, we can be lenient to allow a multifetal reduction if without it there is a very low probability of fetal survival. He agrees that the physician should be the one to decide how many to reduce, and the reduction he feels can be done any time in the pregnancy, but the earlier the better. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, the former Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, considers each fetus to be a rodef vis-a-vis the others. And therefore, according to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, multifetal reduction is mutter because each one is a rodef for the others. He agrees that the physician can decide how many to reduce, and he feels that it can be done by either a Jewish or a non-Jewish physician. He prefers that it be done early in the pregnancy, preferably prior to the 40 days post-conception that the Gemara says the conceptus is kamaya ba'alma, is like mere water. But nonetheless, he says if need be, it's mutter, it's permitted to do the reduction at any point in the pregnancy. Rav Tzvi Kushalevsky, who's the Rosh Hashiva of Heichal HaTorah in Yerushalayim, recently wrote that while multifetal pregnancy reduction is a difficult issue with no clear answer, there is certainly no problem, he feels, according to anyone, of reducing a fetus that is identified as having a fatal abnormality. And finally, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal, quoted by Dr. Yitzchak Melman from a personal communication, says that the halachic problem with abortion really varies depending on when in the pregnancy the abortion is being done. For the bulk of the pregnancy, from the point 40 days post-conception until parturition, until labor, aborting a fetus is not, he says, considered homicide. rather, based on the principle from the Gemara in Chulin that ubar yerech imo, that a fetus is considered to be a limb of its mother, aborting a fetus is actually chavala to the mother. It's injuring the mother, akin to cutting off one of her limbs. And since a person certainly can sacrifice one limb in order to save another, so too it is permitted, he says, to abort one or more fetuses to save the others. So multifetal reduction is permissible. So in conclusion, we've discussed the epidemiology of multiple pregnancy and we've examined its causes and its risks. We've seen what we can do to prevent multiple pregnancies, and we've introduced the medical option of multifetal pregnancy reduction should a multiple pregnancy occur. We've noted that multiple pregnancies are an ancient phenomenon in the history of the world, beginning with the first two human pregnancies. We assumed a general prohibition against feticide, and we briefly set forth the basis for this assumption. We've looked at the halachic concepts of Rodef and Mesira and Yehorig Valyavar, and we've seen how these concepts are central to the discussion of the halachic permissibility of reducing a pregnancy. And finally, we've summarized the opinions of some of the well-known modern poskim who have dealt with the issue of multifetal pregnancy reduction. I appreciate your attention and your interest.